Chapter 28. Boys, we remember with terror how he fell asleep one sultry afternoon with a little smuggled glass before him, and awoke not when the footstep of the chief fell heavy on the floor, how the chief aroused him, in the midst of a dread silence, and said, Mr. Blinkins, are you ill, sir? How he blushingly replied, sir, rather so. How the chief retorted with severity, Mr. Blinkins, this is no place to be ill in, which was very, very true, and walked back solemn as the ghost in Hamlet, until, catching a wandering eye, he called that boy for an attention, and happily expressed his feelings towards the Latin master through the medium of a substitute. There was a fat little dancing master who used to come in a gig, and taught the more advanced among us hornpipes as an accomplishment in great social demand in afterlife, and there was a brisk little French master who used to come in the sunniest weather, with a handless umbrella, and to whom the chief was always polite, because, as we believed, if the chief offended him, he would instantly address the chief in French, and forever confound him before the boys with his inability to understand a reply. There was besides a serving man, whose name was Phil. Our retrospective glance presents Phil as a shipwrecked carpenter, cast away upon the desert island of a school, and carrying into practice an ingenious inkling of many trades. He mended whatever was broken, and made whatever was wanted. He was general glazier, among other things, and mended all the broken windows at the prime cost, as was darkly rumored among us, of 9d. For every square charged 3 and 6 to parents. We had a high opinion of his mechanical genius, and generally held that the chief knew something bad of him, and on pain of divulgence enforced Phil to be his bondsman. We particularly remember that Phil had a sovereign contempt for learning, which engenders in us a respect for his sagacity, as it implies his accurate observation of the relative positions of the chief and the ushers. He was an impenetrable man, who waited a table between whiles, and throughout the half, kept the boxes in severe custody. He was morose, even to the chief, and never smiled, except at breaking up, when, in acknowledgement of the toast, success to Phil, hooray! He would slowly carve a grin out of his wooden face, where it would remain until we were all gone. Nevertheless, one time when we had the scarlet fever in the school, Phil nursed all the sick boys of his own accord, and was like a mother to them. There was another school not far off, and of course our school could have nothing to say to that school. It is mostly the way with schools, whether of boys or men. Well, the railway has swallowed up ours, and the locomotives now run smoothly over its ashes. So fades and languishes, grows dim and dies, all that this world is proud of, and is not proud of too. It had little reason to be proud of our school, and has done much better since in that way, and will do far better yet. Our vestry, we have the glorious privilege of being always in hot water if we like. We are a shareholder in a great parochial British joint stock bank of Balderdash. We have a vestry in our borough, and can vote for a vestryman, might even be a vestryman, mayhap, if we were inspired by a lofty and noble ambition, which we are not. Our vestry is a deliberative assembly of the utmost dignity and importance. Like the Senate of ancient Rome, its awful gravity overpowers, or ought to overpower, barbarian visitors. It sits in the Capitol, we mean in the Capitol building erected for it, chiefly on Saturdays, and shakes the earth to its center with the echoes of its thundering eloquence, in a Sunday paper. To get into this vestry in the eminent capacity of vestryman, gigantic efforts are made, and Herculean exertions used. It is made manifest to the dullest capacity at every election, that if we reject Snozzle we are done for, and that if we fail to bring in Blunderbuss at the top of the poll, we are unworthy of the dearest rights of Britons. Flaming placards are rife on all the dead walls in the borough, public houses hang out banners, hackney caps burst into full-grown flowers of type, and everybody is, or should be, in a paroxysm of anxiety. At these momentous crises of the national fate, we are much assisted in our deliberations by two eminent volunteers, one of whom subscribes himself a fellow parishioner, the other, a ratepayer. Who they are, or what they are, or where they are, nobody knows, but, whatever one asserts, the other contradicts. They are both voluminous writers, indicting more epistles than Lord Chesterfield in a single week, and the greater part of their feelings are too big for utterance in anything less than capital letters. They require the additional aid of whole rows of notes of admiration, like balloons, to point their generous indignation, and they sometimes communicate a crushing severity to stars, as thus, "Men of Menaimount, is it, or is it not, a asterisk to saddle the parish with a debt of 2745 pounds 6s 90, yet claim to be a rigid economist? Is it, or is it not, a asterisk to state as a fact what is proved to be both a moral and a physical impossibility? Is it, or is it not, a asterisk to call 2745 pounds 6s 90, nothing, and nothing, something? Do you, or do you not want a asterisk to represent you in the vestry? Your consideration of these questions is recommended to you by a fellow parishioner." It was to this important public document that one of our first orators, Mr. Magg of Little Winkling Street, adverted when he opened the great debate of the 14th of November by saying, "Sir, I hold in my hand an anonymous slander," and when the interruption, with which he was at that point assailed by the opposite faction, gave rise to that memorable discussion on a point of order which will ever be remembered with interest by constitutional assemblies. In the animated debate to which we refer, no fewer than 37 gentlemen, many of them of great eminence, including Mr. Wixby of Chumblington Square, were seen upon their legs at one time, and it was on the same great occasion that Dogginson regarded in our vestry as a regular John Bull. We believe, in consequence of his having always made up his mind on every subject without knowing anything about it, informed another gentleman of similar principles on the opposite side, that if he cheeked him, he would resort to the extreme measure of knocking his blessed head off. This was a great occasion. But, our vestry shines habitually. In asserting its own preeminence, for instance, it is very strong. On the least provocation, or on none, it will be clamorous to know whether it is to be dictated to, or trampled on, or ridden over roughshod. Its great watchword is self-government. That is to say, supposing our vestry to favor any little harmless disorder like typhus fever, and supposing the government of the country to be, by any accident, in such ridiculous hands, as that any of its authorities should consider it a duty to object to typhus fever, obviously an unconstitutional objection, then, our vestry cuts in with a terrible manifesto about self-government, and claims its independent right to have as much typhus fever as pleases itself. Some absurd and dangerous persons have represented, on the other hand, that though our vestry may be able to beat the bounds of its own parish, it may not be able to beat the bounds of its own diseases, which, say they, spread over the whole land, in an ever-expanding circle of waste, and misery, and death, and widowhood, and orphanage, and desolation. But, our vestry makes short work of any such fellows as these. It was our vestry pink of vestries as it is that in support of its favorite principle took the celebrated ground of denying the existence of the last pestilence that raged in England, when the pestilence was raging at the vestry doors. Dogginson said it was plums. Mr. Wixby of Chumblington Square said it was oysters. Mr. Magg of Little Winkling Street said, amid great cheering, it was the newspapers. The noble indignation of our vestry with that un-English institution, the Board of Health, under those circumstances, yields one of the finest passages in its history. It wouldn't hear of rescue. Like Mr. Joseph Miller's Frenchman, it would be drowned, and nobody should save it. transported beyond grammar by its kindle dire. It spoke in unknown tongues, and vented unintelligible bellowings. More like an ancient oracle than the modern oracle it is admitted on all hands to be. Rare exigencies produce rare things, and even our vestry, new hatched to the woeful time, came forth a greater goose than ever. But this, again, was a special occasion. Our vestry, at more ordinary periods, demands its meed of praise. Our vestry is eminently parliamentary. Playing at Parliament is its favorite game. It is even regarded by some of its members as a chapel of ease to the House of Commons. A little go to be passed first. It has its stranger's gallery, and its reported debates. See the Sunday paper before mentioned, and our vestrymen are in, and out of order, and on and off their legs, and above all are transcendently quarrelsome, after the pattern of the real original. Our vestry being assembled, Mr. Mag never begs to trouble Mr. Wigsby with a simple inquiry. He knows better than that. Seeing the honorable gentleman, associated in their minds with Chumblington Square, in his place, he wishes to ask that honorable gentleman what the intentions of himself, and those with whom he acts, may be, on the subject of the paving of the district known as Pigloom Buildings. Mr. Wigsby replies with his eye on next Sunday's paper that in reference to the question which has been put to him by the honorable gentleman opposite, he must take leave to say that if that honorable gentleman had had the courtesy to give him notice of that question, he, Mr. Wigsby, would have consulted with his colleagues in reference to the advisability, in the present state of the discussions on the new paving rate, of answering that question. But, as the honorable gentleman has not had the courtesy to give him notice of that question, great cheering from the Wigsby interest, he must decline to give the honorable gentleman the satisfaction he requires. Mr. Mag, instantly rising to retort, is received with loud cries of spoke. ... from the Wigsby interest, and with cheers from the Mag side of the house. Moreover, five gentlemen rise to order, and one of them, in revenge for being taken no notice of, petrifies the assembly by moving that this vestry do now adjourn, but is persuaded to withdraw that awful proposal, in consideration of its tremendous consequences if persevered in. Mr. Mag, for the purpose of being heard, then begs to move that you, sir, do now pass to the order of the day, and takes that opportunity of saying that if an honorable gentleman whom he has in his eye, and will not demean himself by more particularly naming and cheers, supposes that he is to be put down by clamor, that honorable gentleman, however supported he may be, through thick and thin, by a fellow parishioner, with whom he is well acquainted, cheers and counter-cheers, Mr. Mag being invariably backed by the ratepayer, will find himself mistaken. Upon this, 20 members of our vestry speak in succession concerning what the two great men have meant, until it appears, after an hour and 20 minutes, that neither of them meant anything. Then our vestry begins business. We have said that, after the pattern of the real original, our vestry in playing at Parliament is transcendently quarrelsome. It enjoys a personal altercation above all things. Perhaps the most redoubtable case of this kind we have ever had, though we have had so many that it is difficult to decide, was that on which the last extreme solemnities passed between Mr. Tittypot of Gumption House and Captain Banger of Wilderness Walk, in an adjourned debate on the question whether water could be regarded in the light of a necessary of life, respecting which there were great differences of opinion, and many shades of sentiment. Mr. Tittypot, in a powerful burst of eloquence against that hypothesis, frequently made use of the expression that such and such a rumor had reached his ears. Captain Banger, following him, and holding that, for purposes of ablution and refreshment, a pint of water per diem was necessary for every adult of the lower classes, and half a pint for every child, cast ridicule upon his address in a sparkling speech, and concluded by saying that instead of those rumors having reached the ears of the honorable gentleman, he rather thought the honorable gentleman's ears must have reached the rumors, in consequence of their well-known length. Mr. Tittypot immediately rose, looked the honorable and gallant gentleman full in the face, and left the vestry. The excitement, at this moment painfully intense, was heightened to an acute degree when Captain Banger rose, and also left the vestry. After a few moments of profound silence, one of those breathless pauses never to be forgotten, Mr. Chib of Tuckett's Terrace, and the father of the vestry, rose. He said that words and looks had passed in that assembly, replete with consequences which every feeling mind must deplore. Time pressed. The sword was drawn, and while he spoke the scabbard might be thrown away. He moved that those honorable gentlemen who had left the vestry be recalled, and required to pledge themselves upon their honor that this affair should go no farther. The motion being by a general union of parties unanimously agreed to, for everybody wanted to have the belligerents there, instead of out of sight. Which was no fun at all. Mr. Mag was deputed to recover Captain Banger, and Mr. Chib himself to go in search of Mr. Tittypot. The captain was found in a conspicuous position, surveying the passing omnibuses from the top step of the front door immediately adjoining the beetle's box. Mr. Tittypot made a desperate attempt at resistance, but was overpowered by Mr. Chib, a remarkably hale old gentleman of 82, and brought back in safety. Mr. Tittypot and the captain being restored to their places, and glaring on each other, were called upon by the chair to abandon all homicidal intentions, and give the vestry an assurance that they did so. Mr. Tittypot remained profoundly silent. The captain likewise remained profoundly silent, saying that he was observed by those around him to fold his arms like Napoleon Bonaparte, and to snort in his breathing actions, but too expressive of gunpowder. The most intense emotion now prevailed. Several members clustered in remonstrance round the captain, and several round Mr. Tittypot, but both were obdurate. Mr. Chip then presented himself amid tremendous cheering, and said that not to shrink from the discharge of his painful duty, he must now move that both honorable gentlemen be taken into custody by the beadle, and conveyed to the nearest police office, there to be held to bail. The union of parties still continuing, the motion was seconded by Mr. Wigsby on all usual occasions Mr. Chip's opponent, and rapturously carried with only one dissentient voice. This was Dogginson's, who said from his place let him fight it out with fists, apostrophe but whose coarse remark was received as it merited. The beadle now advanced along the floor of the vestry, and beckoned with his cocked hat to both members. Every breath was suspended. To say that a pin might have been heard to fall would be feebly to express the all-absorbing interest and silence. Suddenly, enthusiastic cheering broke out from every side of the vestry. Captain Banger had risen being, in fact, pulled up by a friend on either side, and poked up by a friend behind. The captain said, in a deep determined voice, that he had every respect for that vestry and every respect for that chair, that he also respected the honorable gentleman of Gumpton House, but that Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.